These are eggs. Quick whisk, no risk, protein punch, power lunch, bake for dinner, easy winner, fed the lot, hit the spot, eggs. And why pick up more eggs when you're shopping? Because there are more ways to enjoy them. Like bacon and mushroom fried rice with poached eggs, delicious sautéed potatoes with spinach and eggs, or everyone's favourite, a simple cheese omelette for lunch. So versatile, so nourishing. And always choose eggs with a Board Bia quality mark for the highest standards verified at every stage. Eggs. Crack on.
Yeah, having my head shoved into the steps of the Ulster Bank in Ranelagh, cold butt of a gun put into the back of your skull, that's a moment where you go, okay, yeah, I think this one's up.
How does a high-flying academic become one of Ireland's most prolific bank robbers?
What I would see as the most important part of this still lies open.
I'm Not Here to Hurt You, a brand new series from the award-winning team behind the Indo Daily.
That November day, that's where it all begins.
Out now, wherever you get your podcasts. This is an Irish Independent podcast.
Jack had admired Elon for a really long time before Elon ever sort of showed up in the picture at Twitter. He was someone that he often referred to as his favorite tweeter whenever anyone would ask Jack that question. They had a relationship, they were friendly, and when the time came for Jack Dorsey to leave Twitter, he sort of had this feeling that the company needed to be private, that it couldn't really accomplish its goals as a publicly traded company. When Elon Musk showed up sort of unexpectedly as the largest shareholder of Twitter, Jack Dorsey was pretty ecstatic about this. And he reached out to him and essentially said, you know, we need to get you involved. And you may remember originally that was in the form of getting Elon Musk on the board of Twitter.
Hello and you're welcome to The Big Tech Show with me, Adrian Weckler. Now, what really happened when Elon Musk bought Twitter, now X? What role did Jack Dorsey have in it? And how relevant will Twitter or X continue to be? Well, I'm delighted to say that my guest today is someone who knows all about this and who has written a terrific book on it. Kurt Wagner is the tech reporter for Bloomberg, who has broken many stories about Twitter, and he has just or is about to publish a book called Battle for the Bird, Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and the $44 billion fight for Twitter's soul. It's available later this month on hardback and also on ebook and audio. Kurt, can I ask, first of all, you're welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
The timeline of how and why Jack Dorsey, a very gentle man, a gentle soul, a contemplative soul, chose and persuaded Elon Musk, of all people, to become interested in buying Twitter. Why or how did that happen?
Well, Jack had admired Elon for a really long time before Elon ever sort of showed up in the picture at Twitter. And, you know, he was someone that he often referred to as his favorite tweeter whenever anyone would ask Jack that question. And they had a relationship. They were friendly. And when the time came for Jack Dorsey to leave Twitter, he sort of had this feeling that, you know, the company needed to be private, that it couldn't really accomplish its goals as a publicly traded company, and that instead it needed, you know, someone or something to come in and buy it and sort of shield it from all the pressures that come with being, you know, publicly traded on Wall Street. And so when Elon Musk showed up sort of unexpectedly as the largest shareholder of Twitter, Jack Dorsey was pretty ecstatic about this. And he reached out to him and essentially said, you know, we need to get you involved. And you may remember originally that was in the form of getting Elon Musk on the board of Twitter. But as he started to learn more about the company and as he continued to speak with Jack, actually, and they had private conversations, he sort of came to agree with Jack's assessment that Twitter could only be fixed if it was private. And, you know, we all know how that turned out a few weeks later.
And from Jack Dorsey's point of view, what were the main problems of it being a public company? What did he want to achieve, or what did he think was holding the company back?
Well, there's a lot of pressure when you're a publicly traded company, right? You have to report earnings every quarter. You're on this hamster wheel for growth, right? You need to consistently show that the users are growing and therefore the revenue is going to grow. And it's sort of this never-ending cycle that I think created a lot of pressure for him. But I think most or more than anything was this tension between Twitter's business, which was an advertising business, and this feeling that the company could not uphold the values of free speech at the same time, right? So if you are trying to build an audience, if you're trying to appease advertisers and grow your business, you inevitably have to clean up the service. You have to take certain things down. You have to remove hate speech. You have to remove misinformation. And a lot of those things can be tricky if you are a real free speech absolutist, as Elon Musk likes to call himself, right? There's just a tension there between luring advertisers and sort of letting people say whatever they want. And I think more than anything, that tension was what bothered Jack Dorsey and ultimately what bothered Elon and one of the reasons that he chose to buy the company.
Now, I've met Jack Dorsey and he has always struck me, as I said before, as a very gentle, contemplative type of person. I'm not sure you might correct me on that or you might say that you have found other things in his characteristics, but I wouldn't certainly have put him in the same bracket as the kind of person and the kind of culture that Elon Musk has appeared to have developed now for Twitter or X. Do you think that Jack Dorsey there were any inklings to him of what was to come? Or do you think this came as a surprise to him, the direction, the cultural direction that X ended up taking?
I would agree with your assessment. I mean, Jack is really soft-spoken. He's very thoughtful. You know, I do think he's sort of well-intentioned. And I have been describing him a bit as an idealist, right? He very much sees and believes that maybe the best of a person or the best of a situation is going to come about, which is what I assume and think that he saw when Elon Musk showed up, right? I mean, there were signs for those who were paying attention. Elon had already gotten himself into trouble several times for the things that he tweeted. He'd been sued because of his tweets. You know, culturally, I think Jack and Elon are very different people in terms of how they build an organization, how they run a company. But again, I think that Jack, because he's this idealist, because he thought, well, Elon's intentions are good, he probably overlooked the reality that, you know, a lot of the things that Elon tweets can get him and his companies in trouble. And we've seen that happen again and again since he took over. But I think, you know, Jack Dorsey was probably seeing the idealistic version of this situation in which, you know, Elon was not only you know, had the right intentions, but that his actions followed those intentions. And I don't think we've really seen that play out that way.
Yeah, I wonder, is it the idealism that's the problem here, though? Because Elon Musk's previous tweets that did get him into trouble and particularly got him into trouble with financial authorities in the US were maybe more of a legal and technical nature. But the culture, the way he started to tweet, the type of accounts he started to solely interact with, I would imagine are very, very far from the kind of culture that Jack Dorsey would associate himself with. I'm wondering, is this something that, you know, was this a persona that crept up on Musk, or was it always there and something that Jack Dorsey didn't see?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've been getting that question a lot as well. Like, what happened to Elon, right? Because it does feel like there's been a very noticeable change in his behavior over the last couple of years since he took over the company. And even he sort of acknowledged, at least politically, right? His political leanings, he has acknowledged, have moved, you know, further right, more conservative on the US political spectrum than they were before. And we certainly see that in some of the things that he says or tweets now and who he's interacting with. And I don't fully know if there was any one moment that sort of sparked this change. I think there were probably several. I know that, you know, the Biden administration here in the US has been very critical of Elon Musk. And I think that was probably a very frustrating thing for him, considering all he's done with Tesla around, you know, trying to fix climate change and to, you know, usher in this new age of electric vehicles and things like that. And then to have the political party that's usually supportive of all that type of stuff sort of attack him, I'm told, bothered him. But again, that's just one thing. And I really don't think it's any one thing. I also think there's a reality when you're as popular on Twitter as Elon is, and you get that feedback over and over and over. And for him, he kind of came in to say, I'm fighting against what Twitter is, and what Twitter was a little bit more left-leaning and liberal, I think. And so, you know, he sort of becomes a champion for the opposite of those things. And I think when you start to get encouragement and praise and, you know, this wheel of reinforcement, I wonder if that continues to kind of push him further right on the political spectrum since he's taken over.
I think that sounds like a very, very good theory. It's just curious that his reaction to what you describe as, say, criticism maybe from the Democratic Party and that side of the aisle kind of has manifested itself in the last 2 years from our viewpoint over this side of the Atlantic, not just in supporting figures such as Conor McGregor, you know, who had a very controversial fulcrum in the Dublin riots here. I'm not sure if you caught any of that, but also just turning up down on the border between the US and Mexico. And again, to bring it back to Jack Dorsey, I can't help but wonder when he sees Elon Musk going on every day nonstop about, you know, the threat to our culture, the, you know, how weak the border is, all that sort of stuff. It's so far away from what I would have thought Jack Dorsey might have idealized himself.
I think you're right. I think where maybe they overlapped was in this kind of vision for how speech should have been handled online. We know now that Jack Dorsey was very uncomfortable with how Twitter ultimately handled President Donald Trump's account by banning it after the riots in January 6th here at the U.S. Capitol. We know that he was uncomfortable with how Twitter handled its stance on misinformation related to COVID back in 2020 and 2021. And so I do think that Jack, again, in this idealistic viewpoint, felt like, well, we need to create a space online where people can say what they want, even if I disagree with it, or even if it is inaccurate or whatever it may be. And I think that's where he and Elon really overlapped. It's hard for me to imagine that Jack would have shared any of the same views that Elon has, to your point, you know, around the border, around immigration, around some of these other kind of issues, certainly these social issues around trans people, for example. Like Elon has been, he's used dead names, or he's mocked the idea of pronouns, things like that. Those are not the types of things that we ever saw from Jack Dorsey, certainly when he was running Twitter. So while I do think there is, you know, a small subset of ideas or beliefs that maybe they did overlap, I do think they're very different in a lot of other ways, as you point out.
Now, you go into a lot of detail, and there's an awful lot of research in the book about the deal itself, about the saga that was so long in Elon Musk actually acquiring Twitter. At the time, we all remember there were months and months of him trying to claim that it was bots that was holding up the deal and other things. Do you think that was all just smoke and mirrors, really, that he realized he got trapped into a high price deal?
I do. I think that, you know, having spoken with people who were close to the deal, who were very involved, I have yet to find anyone who really truly believes that he thought the bot issue was as serious as he was making it out to be. I think from what we've seen and what we know, he obviously rushed to get the deal done. He signed, in his own words, a very seller-friendly deal. And then the stock market in the U.S. took a really big turn. You know, there was a war happening in Europe. Inflation was skyrocketing. And, you know, he realized quite quickly, uh-oh, I made a bad deal. And how can I either renegotiate this deal or even get out of this deal? Well, I need to come up with something that would be a material business effect, right? Basically, could I trap Twitter into a lie of some kind that would materially change the value of this company? And I think bots was something that he pushed for. Obviously, it did not work. I think it was sort of a unconvincing argument, considering he himself had talked about the problem of bots on Twitter for a long time. So it was something he definitely knew about before acquiring the company. But I get the sense, again, from having spoken with so many people, that this was more of a tactic to try and renegotiate his deal rather than something he was actually worried about.
And much of what we've talked about, particularly the cultural stuff, particularly Elon Musk shooting his mouth off, contributed to a climate once he had bought the company, when advertising revenue, on which Twitter almost exclusively relied and still heavily relies on now, started to crater. It fell off a cliff. And I think at one point you were saying that it was down 50%, then climbing to 60% in the US. Do you see any of that turning around? Because we do hear Linda Yaccarino sometimes try to claim that, well, actually 90% of advertisers have come back to X, but doesn't go into detail there. Can Musk turn this around from a business point of view?
I'm pretty skeptical because the conversations that I have with the advertisers pretty much center around one issue, which is the unpredictability of Elon himself, right? I think at the beginning, there was some concern. Okay, what is the feed going to look like? Are my ads going to show up in feed next to hate speech or racism or something like that? And a lot of advertisers paused out of fear for what might happen. But I think to X's credit, they've done a better job of convincing advertisers that that's not going to happen, or giving them some kind of controls to determine, okay, where do my ads show up in the feed? But what they can't control is Elon's own behavior and Elon's own tweets. And nobody wants to be spending money and taking out a major ad campaign on X the same day that Elon suddenly tweets something racist or something homophobic or something sexist, right? And you just don't know when those things are going to happen.
Well, you do know. You know it's going to happen every 48 hours.
Well, I was going to say, you know it will happen. You don't know exactly when. Mm. And nobody wants to be running an ad right next to Elon Musk's tweets on the day that he chooses to do that. And so the reward for advertising on X, or the return, is not worth the risk to a lot of brands that I've spoken with. Mm-hmm. And as a result, until Elon changes his own behavior, I just don't see those people coming back.
And the super app, all of the other services, the banking, all of this stuff that was going to bring in loads of money, how's that coming along?
I'm skeptical there too, because that requires such a change in user behavior, right? It's not just a feature that aligns with what we know of from Twitter from years past. You know, the idea of using X as your banking app, the idea of storing money there or using it for payments, it would just require such a change in the way that people are familiar with the app right now. And I think that, quite frankly, I think he's underestimating how hard that will be. And so I am skeptical that that's going to ultimately save the business. It'll be interesting to see him try. But again, I'm reluctant to say that, you know, the everything app idea is going to be a huge success.
Maybe like Donald Trump selling steaks. I don't know. Now, we've spoken about the Jack Dorsey era. And of course, at that time, he and others built Twitter into this trusted information source. You could query its direction. You could query some of the things that it was doing. But by and large, it was a centrifugal force, particularly for big breaking news events. And depending on who you talk to now, X, you would argue, still is a fairly central online source. But to what degree? I mean, I was looking at commentary there from Casey Newton the other day, who was quoting figures that suggest that maybe it's looked at 30% less than it used to be, whereas the company itself would claim that its own traffic is higher. What should we think of Twitter and X now as the place where news inevitably gathers?
I think it's become less useful as a news source, at least for me. I still use it, so I don't want to suggest that I don't get any value from it. And in fact, around major events, I do think it's pretty good. I was on X a lot during the Super Bowl, even the Oscars here in the US. I thought X was decent. You know, a lot of people sort of talking about the one thing that's going on in culture. But I think on a daily basis, I open it up, and instead of seeing sort of news of the day, I'm much more greeted with videos that seem to me more like viral videos, right? Or the types of things that are sort of like shock and awe to try and keep you maybe engaged for the wrong reasons. And I just think that he's talked about wanting to make X an entertainment service and sort of like the most entertaining place on the internet. Well, entertainment and news are not always the same. They don't always overlap. And so for me, I've seen the direction go more towards the entertainment side and less towards the news useful side. It can mean that you end up scrolling a lot, but you don't get as much value from it. That's certainly been my experience. And it's been disappointing because I thought that X, or previously Twitter, its superpower was that it was great for news. And if you were a news junkie, or if you truly cared about what was going on around you, you couldn't get it anywhere else. And I feel like he's made that part of the app much worse, in my opinion.
Do you think Jack Dorsey regrets his part in pushing this over to Elon?
I think that Jack believed that Twitter was in a really bad spot no matter what, and that something had to be done. So I don't think he regrets it, because I think he believes that they were in a lose-lose situation. They had to do something. Now, he might feel, and I think he sort of said that he feels that things haven't gone the way he intended, but I think he would blame a lot of other things about why X is in the situation it is right now versus his own role. I think he would say, well, this is Wall Street's fault, or this is the board's fault, or this is investors' fault. You know, they put us in an untenable situation. But I think in reality, Twitter was probably in a better place than Jack believed that it was. And obviously everything that's happened since, I think, is directly, you know, tied to his own behavior and his own relationship with Elon Musk.
Finally, you're quite a senior, quite an eminent journalist, if you don't mind me saying so.
And there's well, thank you.
There's no question that both Jack Dorsey and Elon Musk are going to be both aware and probably interested in this book, which is published later this month. Are you ready to be dragged by Elon in front of 180 million people?
I don't know if anyone's ever ready for that, but we will see. We will see if he responds. I did not speak to him for the book. It says in the book that I reached out several times in an attempt to speak and wasn't able to. So, you know, I did want to give him an opportunity to share his perspective on some of these things. But yes, there's always a risk when you write anything critical of someone with that type of an audience that you're going to hear from him in a way that could be rather public. So if that's the case, wish me luck. I hope I'm the character of the internet for a very short time.
Well, the book is called Battle for the Bird: Jack Dorsey, Elon Musk, and the $44 billion fight for Twitter's soul. And it's written by Kurt Wagner, who has been our guest today on the podcast, and is available later this month on hardback from Hodder and Stoughton, and also available in ebook and in audio format. You've been listening to The Big Tech Show. JJ Clark produced. Gavin Hennessy was on sound. And we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
These are eggs. Quick whisk, no risk, protein punch, power lunch, bake for dinner, easy winner, fed the lot, hit the spot, eggs. And why pick up more eggs when you're shopping? Because there are more ways to enjoy them, like bacon and mushroom fried rice with poached eggs, delicious sautéed potatoes with spinach and eggs, or everyone's favourite, a simple cheese omelette for lunch. So versatile, so nourishing. And always choose eggs with a Board Bia quality mark for the highest standards verified at every stage. Eggs. Crack on.